Right now, it's hotter than Basil Marceau's gubernatorial campaign.
I was making some sausage, and the fat came out and squished over my hand.
You have to be careful.
Don't buy any cheap sausage.
Still, we look ahead to the Witching Month with Tiny Cat Pants creator Betsy Phillips talking about her upcoming book, A City of Ghosts.
Oh, like that's just a crazy legend.
Really like it.
Plus, the state of publishing in 2010, laptops on ice, and somehow I end up wearing a fake fur coat. All this and more on episode 23 of the Nashville Tech Feed.
To the Batmobile.
Person. Are you pondering what I'm pondering?
You're excited. It's really simple.
You have some mighty interesting people online.
No! Turn it on! Turn it back on!
Welcome to episode 23 of the Nashville Tech Feed, the show that dives into the tech news of the day from Nashville and affects Music City. Everything you need to know about the show is at NashvilleTechFeed.com. You can also leave us a voicemail at 615-280-0505. Please leave us voicemail. We really want to hear from you. This week, we are focusing on e-publishing and how publishing is changing because of new technology. And, of course, let's meet our panelists. First one, my co-host, and I have something clever to say, but I'll introduce him first. Independent journalist, instructor at Belmont University's Media Studies Department, Lucas Hendrickson, and the purveyor of laptops on ice.
Purveyor of laptops on ice. Well, see, now that sounds like it's something that ought to be playing down at the Bridgestone Arena. Laptops on ice. You know, is Disney going to produce that? Because there could be actually some big money in that. That's actually not a bad idea.
Well,
no, literally, as we record this, my laptop is sitting on an ice pack in hopes that my pretty much daily now overheating problem that seems to be happening won't happen when I'm in the middle of some pithy thought. And speaking of pithy thoughts,
we have returning for her second podcast appearance, Betsy Phillips, who is is marketing new media associate at Vanderbilt University Press, chief bottle washer and blogger at Tiny Cat Pants, and contributor at Nashville Scene's Pith and the Wind. And
the views expressed on the Nashville Tech Feed podcast do not necessarily reflect those of Vanderbilt University Press, Vanderbilt University, or any other business or educational institution located on West End Avenue in Nashville, Tennessee.
Welcome, Betsy.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
How'd you like that intro?
It was awesome. It was awesome.
I just can't believe I got through that in one reading. I don't even want to try that again. I mean,
we're
pulling back the curtain here. There was no edit on that.
That was good.
Until we go back in and, you know, screw it all up again.
Do we actually edit?
No. that would mean that we had some sort of expertise at doing whatever it is this is we're doing.
Yeah. Don't look my way.
and clearly our fan base would be very disappointed if they found out that we were actually, you know, doing this with any sort of editing tools. It's all an illusion.
Yes, we're holding together with duct tape and ice cubes.
Exactly. Actually, it's close enough to ice cubes.
Yes. But today is actually going to be a very good show. I am so excited because I've been wanting, ever since we've had you on the show previously, Betsy, we've had people ask for you to come back. They really enjoyed when you did the episode when we talked about Nashville is talking going dark. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, right after that show,
remember those halcyon days of old, you know, when there were blog aggregators in town and horses and buggies and et cetera, et cetera. It was an amazing time, I think.
Exactly. You could find out about new bloggers you didn't know about. It was a community. Yeah, those were the days.
Real quick, where do you find out about new bloggers now? If there's like nobody aggregating, there is a website aggregating it, and I've got to remember the name because they've actually asked me to aggregate the Nashville Tech Feed on their site. And it's, I think it's Music City Interactive, I believe. I'll have to look it up. Because they want to start aggregating I'll look it up while you guys talk amongst yourselves. I'll be right back.
I've never heard of that, but I mean, it wouldn't surprise
me.
There would be somebody out there. I mean, and you know, while Dave's checking into that, what seems to be the aftermath of that? There was some hullabaloo after NIT shut down, and on Nashville attempted to come up in its wake, and they had a little hiatus, and now they're back. They're trying to do some theme stuff, but with a little distance from that now, and I know this is completely not the topic that we brought you on to talk about, but quickly, what are your views on a blog aggregator and a hyperlocal blog aggregation role these days? Does anybody actually need to do it?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I think that the blogs that still exist are as popular as they ever were.
Sure.
But I think, you know, obviously there are just a lot fewer bloggers than there were. People are over at Facebook, or they're on Twitter, or they, you know, are on Tumblr. But, you know, I was thinking that somebody who really had a feel and could go out and find funny things on Tumblr or Facebook, or, you know, it seems like there's still a role for introducing people to other people in their community that they otherwise wouldn't have a way to run into. And, sure. You know, that to me is the real drawback to our situation in Nashville right now, is there isn't really any way, if people are up to cool stuff, how do you find out about it since there's not one kind of central location?
Yeah.
And, you know, I just really, you know, we joked about how do you find out about new bloggers, but the truth is I honestly have no idea. You know, I kind of hope sometimes when you see a really witty commenter, you know, I'll click on their name and hope that it leads somewhere, but as often as not, it doesn't.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a real hole in the community.
Well, and I think we've also kind of honed down our commenting, you know, style. Everybody, really short, really incisive, in 140 characters or less. And to live in this in a microblog world, that anything beyond that, and I'm just really just speaking about myself. If I want to do anything more than that, I'm like, okay, I'm gonna fire up the blog and actually sit down and compose something that's worth somebody's time and effort to seek out and read. All of this is interesting. Has been an interesting look at how this segment of self-expression has changed. You know, literally in the past 18 months. So,
right.
I mean, what drives you to continue to not only do your site, but to be as active as you are with Pith in the Wind, and as well as hold down a full-time job?
Well, I honestly don't. I think I'm crazy. No.
And we love for it.
It is kind of nuts, really, when I sit back and think about it. But I also think unlike a lot of people, I write very quickly. Mm. So I can put out a lot of content, but it doesn't take out a lot of my time.
Yeah.
You know, like 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes at lunch, and then 15 minutes, you know, at dinner. It's not that much for me, really. And, you know, and honestly, it's hard for me to resist the allure of Pith. I mean, I know that's funny, but it's one thing when you're sitting at your own blog, you know, spouting off about the state of the world. But, you know, Pith has a lot of readers. And
sure.
To know that somebody from, you know, CNN might see my stuff, or, you know, somebody from Newsweek picks up on something that I've said and runs with it, it's really fun, you know?
Sure.
I mean, that's really cool. So
sure.
that keeps me at it. But it is hard. I mean, I love writing for Pith, but it is hard to regularly come up with stuff that I think would be, you know, like I know what my Tiny Cat Pants fans like, mm-hmm. but it's harder at Pith because you don't get as much positive feedback in the comments. No.
Yeah,
and my trolls are so crappy. Like, I'm finally, like, I am now at war with my trolls because I find it insulting. Yeah. Like, I deserve good trolls. I deserve somebody to sit down and take, I don't know, 3 minutes to come up with, like, coherent, nasty things to say about me. But no, I get the guy who's like, oh, you like to go to the park. Oh, I'm mortally wounded by your astute observation that I go to the park.
So is that an open call to bring out the trolls? It's like, come on, bring
the
best to me. Come on.
I mean,
really, don't we all deserve a better level of trolls? I mean, come on. I mean,
exactly. You know. I would be calling world across the board for trolls in general to step up their game.
Well,
see, this is what happens when that process gets easier. You know, you do have that that new subset of people who they can't even get a good reaction out of you because if you have to spend longer trying to figure out exactly what it is they said, then it probably took them to vomit whatever invective onto the keyboard that they did, then it's just not worth
it. Well, and I got really spoiled because, you know, for a long time at Tiny Cat Pants, I was trolled by hilarious libertarians like Sarcastro and one of his buddies from down in Georgia. And, you know, like, they really knew how to deliver a zing that, you know, like, mortally wounded you and you were laughing. So I just, you know, like I said, I got spoiled. That's what I expect. If you're going to come after me, at least try to make the men who have come before you not embarrassed, you know?
Well, and
although I guess that applies in a lot of different scenarios.
But. Sure. Well, I mean, that's the difference between writing for a niche publication and for a general interest publication. I mean, I've done stuff on and off for newspapers in this town for 20 years, and while I don't tend to get trolled on the stuff that I do, maybe because I'm not sticking my head up out of the ground enough times, but I do know I've seen it enough where, you know, if it's a profile that I've written on somebody and somebody thinks it's great, then whoever the person that has been profiled, they're awesome. If I've said something bad about them, then I am the worst person on the face of the planet. So you get used to that juxtaposition of, you know, the good stuff is always about the subject, the bad stuff is always about you. So
But
Betsy, you have to think that you have plenty to write about with our friend Mr. Basil running for as GOP Republican for the governor race. Would you
know? Well, you know, I find him sad, and I find it sadder that he's only like a notch below some of the really strange stuff that Ramsey and Womp have said. I mean, I'm still like, I don't know if you guys watched the last debate, but at the end of the last debate, Zach Womp, for no reason, shouted out, "I love you."
Missed that.
At nobody. I don't know. I assume it's somebody. I thought maybe that the crowd was large and someone had shouted, you know, "We love you, Zach," and he was shouting back. But then I discovered that, no, there were really only about 40 people in the audience. So if somebody had shouted at him, I would have thought that the microphone picked it up. So I have been left to, you know, conclude that he just randomly shouts out his love for people, which, you know, is a nice quality in a person, I guess, but not
necessarily the state's chief executive.
Right. I'm having a hard time imagining how the state of the state address is going to go if Zach Womp has to stop every 10 minutes and express his feelings for the crowd.
If all of a sudden he becomes Brother Love from the old WWF days, "I love you."
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
I was just going to say our politics would be so improved by a few chair shots.
That's true. it might, you know, certainly on one side of the primary aisle, it might shake some sense into these people. But but we digress. We wanted to have you on because, again, you talk about how quickly you write and you know how it's easy to, well, maybe not easy, but trying to service these audiences with in these various places. But you're in the middle of, or I think if I'm correct, kind of in the tail end of kind of getting a longer form piece of prose together to be published on in real live traditional book form. Talk about that process.
Right. Well, last year for years, every October at Tiny Cat Pants, I have been telling true ghost stories, or, you know, ghost stories that I heard were true or weird things that happened to me. And last year I realized I had told every ghost story that was true that I knew. So I decided that I would write a fake ghost story, one for each night of October.
Wow.
So I decided that, I guess, in July or August, whenever I decided that it was way too late because I was still writing ghost stories into October, and I didn't have any chance to, like, go back and edit them or anything. So they were very, very rough. But it was a hoot. It was the most fun ever I have had blogging. And people really loved it. You know, people sent, you know, links to Boing Boing, and a woman from NPR almost got me on the Weekend Edition. I mean, it was just craziness. It was so cool, and everybody loved the stories, and they were all like, if this were a book, we would buy it. And so I thought, okay, how hard would it be to take these 31 stories and put them together in a book? And, you know, I've gotten great feedback from people, and I had the whole NPR experience that, you know, granted it didn't pan out, but they were really excited. You know, I can't forget, you know, some real news bumped me, but I can't remember what it was. Not important now, real news.
Mm-hmm.
But, but so I spent December putting together a book proposal, and I sent it out to a bunch of places in January, and I got back really awesome rejection letters. But in publishing, a really awesome rejection letter is like getting a B on a paper.
Sure, you know, exactly.
It's not an A, but somebody read it and took the time to say, like, yeah, you're up to something interesting. It's just not for us.
Right.
So, you know, I kind of hemmed and hawed about it. And then I thought, like, gosh, I want to do this again this year. I'd love to have, you know, this great fun experience. But this time, I'm not going to wait until August to start writing the stories because, you know, I wanted the chance to revamp. So I started in May. So through May and the middle of June, I wrote all 31 stories that will appear in their rough, unedited form at Tiny Cat Pants. And then I looked at last year's stories and this year's stories, and I was like, you know, these kind of work together. There's a lot of thematic stuff that's going on. There's some characters that reappear. If I move them around and kind of put them in order, you know, this could really be something. But then the thought of having to go through yet another round of very nice rejection letters, it just didn't, you know, didn't appeal to me. And I sat down with Sue Havlish, who's my direct supervisor at Vanderbilt University Press, and I said, just straight up tell me, like, don't worry about hurting my feelings. Say that you were a small regional publisher who did fiction, and I brought you my book. How many copies, honestly, do you think you could sell? And she said, 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to think, you know, I get 1,000 hits a day at Tiny Cat Pants.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can talk one media outlet in town into writing something. Even if they don't want to review my book because it's self-published, if they just wanted to write a story about, you know, local blogger continues her DIY quest or whatever, I started to think I could sell, maybe not 1,000, but I could sell some. Mm-hmm. And so I started to look into various places to self-publish. And I went to Amazon's Create Space, and they have a, you know, different, all these different royalty structures, but basically the least I would get would be $3 a book for a real book. Now, if you're going to publish a real book with a real publisher, you're going to get about $1 a book, mm-hmm. if you're lucky. So then I realized I only have to sell 333 copies to make as much money as I would have made if I went with a regular publisher.
True.
On top of that, if I put the book out on Kindle and sell it, you know, for $3.99 or $4.99 or some amount that says to the buyer, I'm not trying, you know, like if you give it away on Kindle, I think readers feel like it's probably crap that you're just trying to hook them in with.
I actually don't think you can give them away on Amazon. They don't have a zero price point, do they?
Well, they do have, like, I know a lot of the Christian publishers will give away first books in a series on Kindle in order to get you to buy the rest. I don't know how it works. I haven't gotten that, you know. Like, I assume they're not going to let me do that as low, you know, one-person self-publisher. But, you know, I figure if I charge $3 or $4, somebody might, you know, see the cover and read the description and say, you know, that's a cup of coffee at Starbucks. Okay, I'll put that on. And so that's what I decided to do, I thought, you know. So my goal is to sell 333 copies. If I sell more than that, that will be awesome. But, you know, like I was telling Sue today, if I sell more than that, I'm really going to have to rethink a lot of my ideas about where publishing is heading. Mm-hmm. Because really, if you know how to access your audience, why would you go with a publisher? Now, you know, obviously with an academic press, it's different. You have different needs. You need the peer review. Mm-hmm. You need somebody to send out a bunch of review copies. You kind of need that apparatus. But if you're just a lowly fiction writer with a blog, so you have a way to reach your potential readers, and if you aren't expecting to sell, you know, 50,000 copies, I don't know. I'm kind of wondering, like, and, you know, like, I have stories about the flood. And nobody has to wait 3 years once we, you know, that emotional intimacy and immediacy will still be there when people get their books in October mm-hmm. to read that, you know, so they don't, like, I don't know, just the nature of the whole thing is really appealing. To be able to so quickly turn a book around is really, really nice.
Do you think that the old term pulp fiction, what the definition of that was, wasn't it really small, authors that were putting out their own books? I mean, I'll have to look it up again, but isn't that kind of the new self-publishing is really the direction it's going, but that's where it's came from? Kind of full circle, maybe?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there were, you know, pulp fiction publishers, but they were providing, you know, a lot of the kind of apparatus instead of, you know, like right now publishers say, like, yes, this is good. No, that's not. But the pulp fiction publishers were like, oh, you bring us a manuscript, let's throw something at the wall and see if it sticks.
Yeah.
So in that regard, yes, we have definitely come kind of full back. So I can put my stuff up at Amazon and see what people think of it and let the reader really decide if it's worth their time or not.
Yeah, according to Wikipedia, it says short stories presented in a magazine format printed on cheaply made wood pulp paper. Sorry to interrupt, Lucas, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just, you know, this, it's a, any sort of self-publishing situation these days is almost a cart before the horse kind of situation, in that if all you do is you think you have, I've got some great stories together, I can make the financials work on Amazon, I'll just throw it out there and, you know, I'll make back my money or time or whatever. The chances are people are going to be disappointed with their results. Where Betsy comes at it from a place of strength is that she has already spent time primarily building her brand. She has that external place for which she already has an audience built in. You start that awareness distribution idea through that, and then hopefully maybe a small press or somebody who specializes in what this kind of material is might pick it up on a second go around, and then you kind of walk through the process. Do I want to deal with that kind of thing, or do I want to just keep doing what I'm doing on this level and be happy and fulfilled with that? You know, too many people that, you know, I've talked to people, I've got all these great ideas for a book, and I'm like, well, you got to have something more than that these days. You've got to have an audience that, will get you through that hump of trying to, you know, move some of these pieces of product. Otherwise, it's just going to sit on a shelf.
Exactly. Well, it's right. Kind of like, Betsy, when you had blogged about it, I think a couple weeks ago, I had said, I'm like, go with your strengths, you know, bloggers, get it out to the bloggers, and your strength is you already have an audience with your blog, and you know so many other people that if you send them an e-copy, it's no sweat off your back, because it's digital. Send them a copy right. for their Kindle or their iPad or a PDF and say, could you review this for me? And I can guarantee that the amount of traffic you'd get just from those reviews, your 333 is going to turn into 3,333.
Right. Well, and that'll be crazy. I mean, really, because, a mid-list publisher or a mid-list author sells between 10 and 20,000 copies of their book. If I can sell 3,000 on my own, it's just a sign of how the publishing industry is. The ground is shifting so rapidly, and how the publishing industry used to do things and how they'll have to do things even, in 2 years are going to be radically different. It's going to be so different.
Well, we've done, 20 minutes on this, right? And we don't even have a title yet.
Yes. It's called A City of Ghosts.
A City of Ghosts.
These are fake ghost stories about Nashville and Middle Tennessee in general. I tried to give them some kind of factual or historical hook. So, like Timothy DeMundrian falls in love with the wife of the devil. And Timothy DeMundrian and the woman that he falls in love with, that's all factual. Obviously she did not really, wasn't really taking up with the devil, but, I tried to, I wanted people to be able to read the book and then go find out about the real stuff and be like, oh, that's cool.
Sure.
We're going along in fact this far and now we've veered off into fiction, but the factual stuff is also really cool and interesting. Well, so I hope it'll be a way for people to kind of, look around their city with new eyes.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds a little bit like there's this kind of genre thing going on right now. What was the book? Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter.
Which I'm reading right now.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm reading it right now on my iPad. It was $9.99. And I bought it the way they set this up, and hold that thought, and I'll go quickly here. They set it up where they let you download a sample, like two chapters. And then when you get to the last page of the last chapter they give you, there's a big button that says buy now. And by the two chapters in, they got you. And $9.99 on my iTunes account, I don't feel that. So yeah. Back to you, Liz.
Right.
Well, I was going to say, and that's, there seems to be that moment right now of people taking that kind of, historically accurate, and yet taking it on a, you know, on a, an absurdist turn, which I think, you know, I think there's certainly marketplace for that. And it, you know, once you get the full effect of the Nashville Tech Feed bump, a la the Colbert bump, I think, you know, you just see those orders just absolutely streaming in for ACB.
Great. Well, at the least, your listeners should come to Tiny Cat Pants, because yet again, once an evening throughout October, there will be new stories. There'll be the stories that are in the book, except the stories that are in the book have all been copy edited, whereas the stories that are going up on the blog are. I posted part of a story today, and I was reading it, and I was like, "Oh man, you think I barely knew English?" So I've been very fortunate to have very good friends, you know, giving me a lot of time and expertise to help with that part.
Well, one thing might be that I might suggest is an additional revenue source from this. Since you're taking, you know, live or real facts and putting them into a fictional, just like, you know, I believe really the Da Vinci Code is the one that kind of really, it's not like they were the first one, but they're the one that really got it kickstarted. And now you have all these other things, like, was it, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter and A Pride, Prejudice, and
Pride,
Zombies.
Prejudice, Zombies. Yeah.
With all these stories you put together, I would find books on Amazon, factual books about the real facts in your stories, and link to them through an associate's account. So when people click through to find out more about the truth behind the fiction, you get a little additional revenue off of that as well.
That would be a good idea.
So you're building up these multiple revenue streams where you can be writing full time and you won't have to work at the place that we made the disclaimer for earlier.
Although I love my job very much. So I'm having a good time.
So
while we certainly have a lot more to talk about in the publishing realm, Dave, might we think about revenue streams as well?
Oh, well, yes. Great, great segue. But now if I pointed it out, then it's not really a segue, is it?
Pretty much no.
Well, hold on to your seats, people. We have more after this wonderful ad and brilliant segue. Lucas, did you know that we're hosted through Site5.com?
I've heard tell of that, yes, indeed.
We have been with Site5 since the Nashville Tech Feed had started. And that was way back in 2006, and this is 2010. And I'll tell you, wonderful hosting, excellent support. I have recommended several people to use their services, and everyone that uses it have been thrilled with it. So what I have done is set up a affiliate account with them that if you go to NashvilleTechFeed.com/site5, it'll take you to Site5, where you can check out the wonderful hosting they provide, where you can, for as little as, I believe, $4.95 a month now.
Only $4.95 a month?
Yes, $4.95 a month. Betsy, can you see we've done this before?
not well, mind you.
Not
but
well,
we've done
no.
it.
In fact, it's
I'm convinced, though. I'm convinced.
It's so entertaining, you don't even know it's an ad. But so if you like the Nashville Tech Feed and you want to help support us, you know, go to NashvilleTechFeed.com/site5, and if you like the hosting, sign up for it. And Lucas, I got another thing at the very end because we're going to ask for more money. So,
oh, okay, well,
but
I'll,
getting
I'm,
back, to
I'm
the,
on the edge of my seat waiting for that particular plea. But,
but I want to get back to Betsy and what she's got going. So we've talked about your book a bit, and I want to propose now. Not that sense, but propose that we take one of your stories, if you would let us. And I have a friend that's a vocal, that she's a voice talent, and I'd like to have her read it and record it and put out one whole episode in October for the Nashville Feed or Nashville Tech Feed, just of one of your ghost stories.
That would be awesome.
I would love to do that, and I'm sure she would be love to do it. So
all right, well, once we're
there.
Done here, I will we'll arrange that. I'll make sure that you guys have a copy of the book to flip through.
Excellent. And I'd like you actually to pick the story.
All right, your book. Cool.
So, and also because Dave doesn't actually read. No,
I
I'm kidding.
I have a whole shelf full of books that I've started reading, just never finished. But let's
well, maybe we need this voice talent to, you know, do the story opera style, and you can just download it, put it on your iPod. And
Lucas, you know who I'm talking about, right?
I believe I do, yes.
Can we say your name on the air?
Are we going to get sued?
I don't think so, but we might get an extra listener. See if we keep
that's true.
People,
we would
get more people.
We would
listening.
Increase our fan base by a whole 50% at that point. That would be kind of cool.
We actually have 3 people listening now.
It'd be all women, which is fine with us. But
we have one man. Well, actually, we have 4 people listening that I can think of that have told me.
Oh,
but coming back, her name is Yvonne Smith, and she's actually a local. She's the traveling vegetarian. She
yes. I know her, yes. Or I know of her, anyway. I think I've met her once.
She's a singer-songwriter, and she does the Traveling Vegetarian video blogging, and she's actually in the process, I believe, of writing a book, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very cool.
So,
on traveling vegetarianism?
Among other things.
She does a lot of different things. She's a multi-talented person, just like yourself. But so coming back, kind of like we were talking about the publishing industry in general, do you think it's this whole awakening to, because once you looked at the numbers and realized you could sell 333 copies for what you would have to sell, 1,000 through a publisher?
Yes.
What happens when more and more people discover that? Is this going to decimate the publishing industry?
Well, actually, I actually think what will happen is that, because, you know, I could, if not for our mutual friend, Kristen Whittlesley, or, you know, Beth Downey, or Samantha Juergen, I could not have done this. The 3 of them stepped in with, you know, 1 copy edited, 1 typeset, and 1 did the design. And if I had had to pay, you know, fair market price for all that, then any money I made from the book, if I sold 333 copies, would have all gone to them, and deservedly so. So I think that there's, you know, still a sense in which once you figure out, okay, my expertise is in telling these stories, but I don't have the expertise of design, or, you know, I can't copy edit my own work. Once you know your weaknesses and you accept that you're going to have to pay people, or, you know, beg on hands and knees for people to do that for you. What I think is going to happen is that I actually think that the publishing industry will end up flipping. So instead of a publisher saying yes or no to an author will kind of survey the landscape and say yes or no to a publisher. So if I, for instance, you know, I would say, I need a small regional publisher with an expertise in the South. And I would go to them and they would say, okay, give us, $2,000 and these are the tasks that we'll perform for you. Instead of right now them being the gatekeeper on what's good or bad, I think that part of the role will go away and it will become more and more about the readers deciding what's good or bad, and what they're going to throw their weight behind. I also kind of imagine, too, I was thinking about this, like, if I were Stephen King, Stephen King is kind of in the literary equivalent of, like, a Madonna or a U2. Why does Stephen King need a publisher? What could they possibly provide him that he couldn't hire freelancers to do for him? So I also think we may see models where you'll get, you know, maybe like Stephen King and Dean Koontz will go in with, you know, 10 or 12 other authors, and they'll all throw into a pot to hire a copy editor, a publicist, a designer, all those things, and just have those people working for them. So I do think that the era of kind of the big behemoth publishers is rapidly behind us, but I think we'll see a lot more small boutique publishers spring up, because there is just a lot of, I mean, I I know a lot about publishing because I work at a press, but I can see how it would be very daunting for somebody who didn't even know what kind of steps to take to do what I'm doing. Be a lot less daunting. And, you know, and this is one of the things that Amazon will do for you. You can go through and they say, we will write you a press release for X amount of dollars and distribute it to these places. And you can just go through and, you know, like pick off a menu, the things that you want. I think we'll see a lot more of that just because authors will always need those things. But I think the era of some editor deciding like, yes, this is worth our time or no, it's not. I think that that's behind us. I think that authors will pay publishers instead of publishers paying authors, but then authors will also keep almost all of their royalties after they've paid the publisher. Mm-hmm. That's my prediction anyway.
I kind of agree with that, and I kind of don't. For one thing, your superstar authors are always going to need the services of an organization that can create for them millions of pieces of physical copy, and do the distribution and do the marketing and do all those things. We're going to have fewer of the superstar authors emerge, exactly like we have fewer of the superstar musical artists emerge. But there will still be a need, not as much of a need, not as many places to do it, but there still will be a need for those companies that can be the one-stop shop for those superstar authors, and that can service properly, you know, the retail outlets that will continue to exist. What
all five of them?
Well,
okay. Who's going to be last?
Point what from the author standpoint or the retail standpoint?
From the retail standpoint.
Well, you know.
Well, you also got to consider that Amazon just announced last week that their ebooks now have surpassed hardcover copies.
Just hardcover. That release got so ridiculously overblown and is fun with numbers and doesn't mean everybody completely overreacted to that number.
But you understand that I did phrase it correctly.
You did phrase it correctly, but most of the people who covered that story were, especially in the tech press realm, were like, "Oh my God, Kindles are taking over the book industry."
No, they're not true. Yet. But what is predicted is 2012; it will surpass, and we're not that far off now.
Yeah, that assumes a much wealthier United States than there actually is.
Yeah,
I mean, the fact is, I can still go to Kroger and buy a mass market paperback for $7.99. And that's a lot easier for me to do than it is for me to save up the money to get a Kindle or an iPad. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's already happened that people who own Kindles or iPads, their book buying is probably almost exclusively digital, or at least primarily digital. Those customers have been lost. The affluent customers, the switch has been made.
By the way, we have a internet question that just came in via Twitter.
Holy crap. In real time? No. In real seriously? Time.
Yeah. Freaky Weasel asks, do any of you see a big shift of publishing? Oh, I can't say this word. Why do you send me big words?
See what I said about the reading thing?
Yeah. Stop it.
Use all your words, Dave. Spell it out.
A-N-C-I-L-L.
Ancillary.
Ancillaries. More independent editors, illustrators, etc. selling services directly to authors. Wow. I don't know. We're not streaming live, but he just asked the question we just answered previously.
That is awesome. We are clearly psychic. Clearly.
Somebody tweet to him.
We need to ditch our day jobs and open up a fortune-telling store.
Do you want me to call him? We can get him on the air.
And see, well, that's what I was going to mention. I think the roles aren't going to be so much that, and Betsy certainly hit on this. It's not going to be so much the individual creator is going to now suddenly be empowered to become, you know, this huge author, but they are certainly going to be have the ability to be much more selective about where they take their work. I still think there's going to be need and roles for people to identify talent, identify what's good, identify what can, what can find a market out there. But there will be this, you know, freelance cabal of book creation that can be out there. Again, much like there is indie record labels, indie exactly. filmmakers. And the people who are willing to do the homework, not just the people who have talent, not people the people who think they've got a story that they might be able to tell, the people who can really kind of walk through those waters, and find the team of people to help them pull a physical product together, and by that I mean the digital side of it as well, then they're going to have a much better chance of having that be a success than, you know, just some Yahoo who wants to talk about their, I don't even have a good analogy for that right now, but whoever's going to do the ghostwritten Basil Marceau book.
Sorry.
Which is going to happen.
No, clearly, yes, and clearly the world is clamoring for it. Even if they don't yet know it, they want it.
So the question is, how come if Betsy thinks that the publishing industry is going to go from more of a gatekeeper to a service provider, how come the music industry hasn't done that as well? The labels could become bigger by providing services than just going after the superstars. They have less impact and cost more money to break them.
I think that has happened. We just don't see it as much because people are too busy flinging mud at the downfall of the labels.
Well, it's funny. I just read today an interview with Miranda Lambert, and she was saying how strange it is in Nashville right now because they are actually letting people record the songs the artists want to record. So, like, she was even noticing that there's been this kind of subtle and quick shift where they're trying new things to see what will work. So I'm sorry, Lucas, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
That's absolutely valid because part of that is the thing that has been most decimated within labels is are the A&R departments, you know, the people, the gatekeepers, the people who go out there and identify talent and bring them in and shape them and try to have them ready to be put on some sort of national stage. But it's easier for them to just kind of throw their hands up and go, okay, we'll let artists, you know, determine what they want to, what they want to record, and it's also then their all the impetus is on them to make sure that it ends up succeeding, rather than, you know, it truly being the purview of the label as much. Right. So,
don't you think though that the role of gatekeeper has just moved? I mean, like I must read now 10 music blogs. Mm-hmm. That I never read before, who's, you know, like over at 9bullets.net. I don't know if y'all read this, but it's the most awesome music blog ever. And the kid who runs it, every artist that he finds, maybe not every, 90% of them I would have never heard of and I love. And when you can find that, you know, and like that's my go-to, like that's how I find new music, or through mm-hmm. the blogs, through them sitting down and sorting through oodles of stuff and saying, here's what's good, here's what I know my readers will like. I think that gatekeeping has just moved ends from, you know, at the start to the finish.
I agree with that. I wonder how much, you know, if you were able to take it across the spectrum of everything that you're reading about a certain whatever consumption, about music, about movies, about whatever, which blogs do you find more useful? And are they the ones that actually have editors that are part of the process, or if it's just individuals throwing stuff up there? Because I think you would probably agree with me that you find now that your work is better because you have had editors look at your stuff.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm the exact same way. My writing gets better every time I work with an editor who is not afraid to say, this is good, this could be different, this could be changed, throw this out, I love this part. And that's what I feel like we're losing a lot, certainly in journalism and certainly in the music industry and, you know, probably and, book publishing.
And definitely in publishing. Yeah, definitely in book publishing. But I think the issue is, at least in book publishing, you know, and it's a little different in university press publishing because we kind of are by definition already a boutique.
Sure.
So we could take the time to do a lot of developmental editing and time that certainly other public, I mean, that was one of the ways and still is one of the ways we're able to wrestle books from larger publishers because we can promise someone is going to sit down and help you shape this thing.
Right.
And other presses can't, but they already couldn't. Like that was already going wrong with the publishing industry before all this electronic publishing stuff started to happen. Mm-hmm. Now you'll see a lot of places blame it on e-publishing, but I've lived through it and I can tell you because that's how I got books.
Yeah.
And that was long before this became a consideration. So that's already been wrong.
Yeah. And that's where the over-reliance on analytics can come into play on this, and especially in the cost-cutting measures that have happened across all of these sectors. The first things that have gone are the people that the bean counters don't understand what their roles are.
Right.
They are.
And as you know, somebody who can edit, and I'm sure it's probably true for A&R, I'm just not that familiar, but editing is an art.
It is. It's absolutely an art. And it's a non-quantifiable one that, you know, that people who don't understand that art, especially in the process of a business, will never pick up on. And that's the easiest thing to lop off of a ledger sheet.
Right.
And that's why newspapers have suffered. That's why music has suffered. That's why, you know, book publishing, that's why movies have suffered. It's because that part of the gatekeeping role, that part of everybody's work gets better if you have somebody else's eye on it.
Right.
That's what the bean counters don't understand. And those have been the first jobs that have gone.
Lucas, you're so negative.
Do what?
So negative.
No, but he's
right. I mean, this is, and you know, but I think too that this is one of the reasons that, you know, like I keep saying boutique publishing, but I truly believe that any author who is able to have enough distance from their own work to see it has to see that they need an editor. You know, I mean, you'll pay for it.
Yeah.
If you can afford it. I mean, some people can't, but if you can afford it, you'll pay to have it. But that's another thing, you know, I had got Kristen's help. She's amazing.
Hmm?
She's right here in town. I see her every other week at Wine Knitting. I could have gone to a publisher and I might have still had to hire Kristen to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, or they might, you know, or I might not have gotten somebody at all, and it would have just had to go with what I did. You know, I mean, the book is better for her involvement.
Yeah.
And there wouldn't have been any guarantee at a true publisher that would have happened.
And that's where artists of all stripe need to realize that and come to that moment as well, that, you know, It often takes that person that will have the stones to tell you that your piece of art isn't as good as it could be, and here's how I can help, rather than all those people who are just lining up to pat you on the back and saying that you're the greatest thing, you know, since sliced bread. And Dave, I mean, it may sound like it's coming off negative, but it's more that because we have so many things that we could consume in this. Space and time, I want to have stuff coming across my desk, coming across my eyeballs that isn't going to waste my time. And most of the stuff that is just vanity publishing or, you know, indie records that, you know, all their friends told them that they were great, but in reality, they need a lot more work. All that does is waste my time and wastes my money. And we have too much of that. I want quality to come across my brainstem and you know, be something that I can feel good about telling others.
I hope this show comes across as quality.
We'll see.
How could it not? We're so awesome.
That's all that matters. But to kind of the to you know pull the wrap this all up in a kind of a nice little bow is it's a very similar thing that's happened in other industries that got touched by the reduced cost of publishing and other services. That as that gets reduced, there's more access to people. Maybe not the superstar access like, you know, the Stephen Kings or the Lady Gagas of the world, but the idea is more people have the opportunity to publish at a lower cost. In return, though, we might not have that higher quality that you speak of, Lucas, of having an editor look over your work or having a professional artist do your cover or having a publicist that specifically works for the publisher that knows the industry that can talk specifically to the distributors and the bookstore owners and all that. Have that.
Then what's the point?
Well,
seriously, I mean, we have.
I was trying to wrap it up. That's all. I'm not trying to make a point here.
you kind of were, but yes, we have
unintentionally.
We have all these things, but. And technology has enabled us to, you know, to have so many more of them than we've had before. But is that necessarily a good thing?
That's a question that's out for debate.
Yeah,
I was going to say, like, and that is right there, the $50,000 question.
But
and we're all going to live to see it play out.
I think it's good for the publishers.
If there's money to be made, some big company is going to step in to make it.
Mm-hmm.
They'll find a way to filter through to the, you know, gem in the rough and snap those people up. I mean, it'll just happen. We're just in an enormous period of flux.
Well, it could be that this is the A&R people, instead of having people blindly send them work, that they go out and find publishers such as yourself or self-publishers that have an audience built in, that have, you know, this would be considered your first published piece, correct, Betsy?
Yes.
They could see what you've created on your own with the talent that you have available around you, and they could say, you know what, with a little bit of what we know, we could take that next book and really shine it and make it a spectacular piece of work where she doesn't have to worry about selling 333 copies because we're going to sell 3 million copies.
Well, that would be awesome.
I think you're going to sell a lot more than 333 right now, but...
And just remember who did your first podcast interviews when all that happens.
Yes, remember the little people.
But, I will never forget the people who enabled me to sell 335 copies.
Oh, now we're raising it already. Wow, ego.
Well, I'm hoping for the bump, right?
Yeah. Exactly. It's all about the tech feed bump, you know.
Where? Why don't we wrap it up because we're coming up on an hour here, and I hope everybody was entertained because I'm having a blast. I could go longer, but... I don't know how long our ears out there can stick with me talking. I don't know. Anyway, our final segment of the show, and our timer's run out, Lucas, obviously.
Yeah, that's all
right. Is what we're consuming. And I think, Betsy, last time you were on the show, we had that segment running as well. Oh, wait, I forgot. We have a text message, Lucas.
Uh-oh.
And the text message is from a phone number I'm not going to give out on the air because I don't think she would enjoy that, but it's from one of our listeners. And the text message said, it's directed at you, Mr. Hendrickson.
Yeah, I'm aware of that, and okay.
It would be advisable for Mr. Hendrickson to refrain from ridiculing 50% of your fan base, lest we reveal to him that I'm effing Matt Damon.
It's better.
I'm just saying,
it's better when you read it, you know, physically, not.
I would just like to suggest if 50% of your fan base is female, maybe you could do like naked podcast one week.
No. There's a reason why this is audio only, and it's not just bandwidth. It's not just our lack of technical expertise. Merely speaking for myself.
Yeah, yeah. And after the pontoon thing over the weekend, we're kind of lobster-like.
Quite sunburned right now, but that's neither here nor there.
But for those out there wanting to, you can send us text messages too. We didn't have anybody call in for the song at the end of the show either, or the last blip. So the iTunes gift certificate goes up to $15 next week.
$15 now. Okay.
I'm upping it $5 until somebody wins or until I say no more. And so, call and leave us a message at... Ooh, that's really loud. Sorry, guys.
Here we go again.
615-280-0505. What is that number again, Lucas?
That would be 615-280-0505.
And you can also leave comments at NashvilleFeed.com. So, final segment. What we're consuming. Lucas.
And we really, truly only want the finest quality trolls. sending feedback to all of those devices. Closure. Moving on.
Do you want to antagonize them? Say something like something antagonistic.
You know, with part of our fan base, all I have to do is breathe and I'm being antagonistic. So that's fine. I'll move on from there.
Your breath is this. It's more of a sigh. But Lucas, what are you consuming?
Well, today, what is today? Tuesday, we record this, Tuesday, the 3rd of August, was release day for the new Arcade Fire record, The Suburbs, which kind of was blowing up to Twitters this afternoon this morning and this afternoon. I had an interesting conversation with our friend Morgan Levy from Nashvilleist, and also our friend Eric Chuff from The Tennessean, and...
Come on,
so
throw more names
various,
out.
Various
throw
other names. People talking about how this has been an interesting release for them. Really looking forward to their show at the Ryman Auditorium this coming Monday, which will be about a week before this actually gets posted. So we'll we'll have that in our rearview mirror. But for somebody looking for a fantastic, albeit a little high concept record. For their late summer listening, the new Arcade Fire record, The Suburbs, out now in a bunch of formats.
Very cool, very cool. Did you buy it on CD or MP3, Mr. Anthony?
I bought it on MP3 this morning because Amazon had a release day deal for $3.99 for it.
Is it still going?
I'm sorry?
Is it still going?
I think it's through the end of today. So probably by the time, again, this gets posted, it'll be... probably back to what their $7 or $8 or $9 price point, but again, I just thought it was a brilliant release. They had it available for full listen on NPR.org and some other places. Multiple physical formats, high quality vinyl and CD, like 8 different artwork setups for that, and then a release day special for $4. I just thought they did all the things right. In releasing this record. Other people tell me it's kind of commonplace, but I don't recall that all these things kind of coming together in the same way like this. Plus, the record's great, so that helps. It matters considerably.
Well, very cool. I'll have to check it out. Betsy, do you know what you're consuming, or should I let you go last and think about it?
Oh, no. I was going to say I have been consuming over and over and over again the new The Joiners album. They used to be a Nashville band, but they have moved to Birmingham to have a baby for some reason. I don't know. Maybe babies are better in Birmingham. I don't know. But their latest album, Glorious, Glorious, is clearly made for people in their 30s. It sounds like every song you used to sing along to in your parents' car when you were a little kid. It's got just... You know, their song, the title song of the album, Glorious, Glorious, every time I hear it, it makes me laugh and cry at the same time. And it has, you remember how songs used to have, like, where all the music would, like, drop out? Like, at the point in the concert where you know you're supposed to sing along, this song has that. Like, all the music drops out, and they keep singing, and it's, like, just, you know, Pavlovian, that you sing along because it's just, you know, every, well, you remember, like, every country and every pop song back in the day kind of had that.
That break.
But they make it work. Exactly.
Is it
they
a
really
live
make it work.
Is it a live?
No.
Or is it?
No.
Wow. Okay.
No. So it, yeah. But it's really, it's one of those things where you're like, wow, these people should be, I mean, you know, maybe they shouldn't be stars. I don't know. What do I know about music? But they should be a lot more famous than they are. You know, like, I wish that all of my friends could listen to this and love it. You know, it's not my favorite album ever, but it's one of those things where I'm just like, you know, I mean, it's how many people are in this, you know, these are really talented people who deserve for people to listen to their music and enjoy it. So that's what I'm consuming, the Joiners, Glorious, Glorious.
Very cool.
Plus their album cover, they look like spies.
Spy versus spy?
Well, no, more like Russian spies, you know, like come into our boudoir and
from
we
Birmingham.
Will, you know, steal your secrets after we've drugged your drink.
I thought you were going to say like Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd and spies like that.
That would be even better.
Okay, that would be even more awesome. We should get with them. And
the next record,
that.
It's all about spies like us.
Exactly.
The concept record.
Oh, but, man. Who would... I already want to listen to that.
Well, if they're listening, you've got your next album cover. Moving on to what I'm consuming, I am not as, how would you say, musically inclined lately. I've been just listening to a lot of podcasts. I think it's because I make a podcast, but...
Possible.
The one thing that I'm just raving about is Flipboard for the iPad. This is like an aggregator, but for news that your friends post on Twitter and on Facebook. So the idea is with this, you open it up, you put in your Twitter username and link the account, put in your Facebook name and link the account, and then it goes out there and goes back, you know, a couple of days, finds all the articles that your friends have posted, along with some of the quotes that they put on, and put it into this beautiful magazine format that you just flip through, like, one article at a time. Like, I popped up right now, a friend of mine shared Kanye West tweets matched with New Yorker cartoons. another one.
That's nice.
Tomorrow's High is a picture by Rex Hammock. All it says is hot everywhere. blogging
See,
for brands.
I remember seeing that, and I think it's probably Andy Inako was starting to rave about it. I watched their video, you know, and they're really positioning it as the as a social magazine for the iPad, and thought this could be the one thing that really kind of sends me over the edge about for gadget envy. And then I've been following kind of the discussions that people are having about it being a scraping service, and nobody's getting, you know, the original content. Providers aren't getting the hits, and so this will be an interesting thing to watch to see if it's what the development of this particular product will be. But it looks fantastic.
Oh, I'll tell you, I think they need to put the rest of the ideas of clicking through, because most of the articles that I click on, it gives it just a little bit of a sample of it, and then if it says read more, it clicks through and opens up the web browser, and you hit the page. It's kind of like a RSS feed,
mm-hmm.
but beautifully placed. Like,
yeah,
an article here, how your audience is like the Mogwai through the lens. I mean, but it is
wow.
a beautiful Twitter's here. You know, I can see a half a dozen Twitters from Courtney Rogers, Dave Delaney, you know, Sam Brady, but it I just can't rave about this enough. I use this every single day, several times a day, and it's such a beautiful format. So that's one thing I'm consuming. And switching back to the whole reading thing, because I still know how to read even if I can't talk. And with the iPad, I can look up words right there in the book. So there. Is Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Which we talked about before.
Yes, and that's what brought it up. Excellent read on how the Abraham Lincoln was also one of the greatest vampire hunters in history, and nobody knows about it. And it's written in the same type of format of a historical fiction, where a lot of places and things that happen to him, and then the in-between is filled in with the fiction of the vampires.
Now, is it reading like a Buffy the Vampire Slayer thing, or is it overwrought emo stuff, or is it more kind of straight?
No, it's straight.
Straight historical fiction.
No, I don't feel my. I don't feel like I'm being over. What's the word? Yeah, I'm not growing a vagina by reading it. How's that?
Okay, now 50% of the audience is going to be mad at you.
Well, 50%.
We have 4 listeners now: 2 men, 2 women. It's 50% split. So we've only
if one of the guys was a Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan, and apparently in the Middle Tennessee area there were a lot of them, then we were doomed. We just lost it. So we've lost 75% of our audience. Oh.
No. So I think what you have successfully done is trolled your audience. You will get more listeners because the feminist will be all like, what's wrong with growing a vagina? And the Buffy people will be like, we have to listen to find out how to find these guys and beat them down. So there you go. Good job.
So now do I have to put an explicit warning on this episode?
I don't think vagina is explicit. It's a body part.
Like. I know, but the whole context. Anyway, coming back, it's written by Seth Grantham Smith. I think that's correct. But it's written in the way of from a guy that was just handed the entire diaries of Abraham Lincoln, and he's telling it from his point of view of researching everything about Abraham Lincoln from his diaries. So it's kind of flipping back and forth, and it starts out from when he was a child and as he's growing up, what's happened to him. So it's a great book. I'm really enjoying it. I'm not all the way through it yet, but I'm really liking this book. So with that, our show has come to an end so quickly, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm sorry if I offended everybody. Don't hit me at a happy hour, please. And if I don't get voicemail from this episode, I'm just turning the damn thing off.
Well, yeah, that's...
I dare you to call me and leave a message.
That'd be 615-280-0505.
Wait.
I should have given you more heads up on the phone sounder there, dude. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. Well, anyway. So, Lucas, where can we find you on the internet?
Oh, the usual places. Tune in, Lucas, on Twitter, largelandmammal.com from the... very semi-occasional blogging perspective, although trying to figure out how to make that more of a destination point, shall we say.
Very good. So. Betsy, where can we find you on the internet?
Well, come find me at tinycatpants.com or over at pissinthewind.com. You can follow me on Twitter at AuntB. Or look for my book at Amazon.com in October, A City of Ghosts.
Excellent.
By the way, that's also the Nashville Scenes, not the Nashville Feed, but the Nashville Scenes, Pith, PITHINTHEWIND.com. It's hard, yeah. You fly through it too quickly, much like the disclaimer earlier in the show, when we were much, much younger, people could get confused.
Lucas, I want you to follow me around and just dramatically say things. Like, if I ever get a book tour, it's going to be your job to introduce me everywhere I go.
That would be awesome. Seeing, like, what, Lucas, how tall are you?
I'm shade over 6'6".
So 6'6".
Okay, we'll have to get you a fur coat.
And a fur coat.
For starters.
A fur coat?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Anybody who travels with me has to have an incredibly tacky fur coat. It can be fake.
Okay, good. Because Because really, you know, anything that could remotely tie me to John Rich, I have no desire for whatsoever.
John Rich wishes his fur coat made him look as good as you will look in yours.
Lucas, have you ever been drunk?
Wow, I was really going to throw something out there that would necessitate the explicit that, tag. But
if you have, you're close enough to where... You know what? This, one of the squares was it the CMA Apocalypse was, right?
Do you remember that? That was so long ago, and I've tried to divorce myself from those memories. What was it?
Wasn't it the Gimme Square, John Rich, somewhere drunk in Nashville?
Probably was.
So, anyways, allegedly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Yes. All right. We're going to wrap it up, guys. My name is David Baranja, and you can find me at NashvilleTechFeed.com, where occasionally I blog without an editor. And you can also find me, I go by MDave on Twitter. You can also follow the Nashville Feed on Twitter, which is kind of the core name of the website, because Tech Feed is what we do for the podcast, and the Nashville Feed is what we don't blog at very often. You can also find us at techpodcasts.com, and we're part of the Tech Podcast Network, where you can find a whole bunch of other tech podcasts, and we thank them for letting us be part of their feed. You can also get comments at nashvillefeed.com and leave us a message at 615-280-0505. And Lucas, how are we going to end the show?
With some random sound clip that, if people pay attention, they could win a $15 iTunes gift card.
And that is correct, but the we need a disclaimer. Give me a disclaimer. Any previous guests?
I'm sorry, what?
Any previous guests on the Nashville Tech Feed, or people that personally know us on the Nashville Tech Feed, or have called in previously and won things, or
have been sunburned with us on a pontoon boat within the last 30 days.
That's all. That's almost our entire audience.
Well, that's true, but you know, I'm trying to, you know, rally new troops to the cause rather than.
No, we doubled our audience. We've got four, and actually, I want to say thank Freaky Weasel for his somehow like psychic connection to us tonight on the internet. And before I play the thing, we're gonna put up a tip jar on the Nashville Tech Feed because I'd like to buy a mixing board. So if you really like the show, we'd appreciate you if you throw a couple bucks in there. We need about $200 for a mixing board so that we can get more shows out and on a more timely basis. So here we go.
Why are you messing with the fantasy? We know about the reality. Don't ruin the fantasy, okay?